From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Twitter arrived 5 years ago. Some scoffed, many scratched their heads. Tweets were so small, so short. 140 characters of text. What could they say that mattered? Well, quite a lot, it turns out. 300 million registered users, 100 million actively tweeting in any given month. Yes, some of it's still what we had for lunch. But also history-changing tweets sent by regular folks zipping right past helmets and clubs and through prison bars. It's a social network fueling chit-chat and social upheaval, changing power dynamics, changing the news. It's chaos, but it's us communicating, only much faster, much further. This hour on Point, what Twitter is teaching us, where it's taking us. You can join the conversation. How do you see it? Silly tweets or a new nervous system, a game changer? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now are two people who have spent a lot of time thinking about what Twitter means, how it's changing us, how to use it, and who have, in their own ways, changed Twitter. From Washington, we're joined by Andy Carvin, senior strategist at NPR's social media desk. He became a one-man newswire during the Arab Spring. The online newspaper, The Daily Dot, named him second only to the hacktivist group Anonymous in his influence on Twitter in the year 2011. His Twitter handle is acarvin. Andy Carvin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And joining us from New York City is Clay Shirky, professor of new media at New York University, a really big thinker in the brave new digital world. Top of the heap, he's the author of Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age, and Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations. His Twitter handle is C. Shirky. Clay Shirky, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What do you think of what it's become versus, you know, sort of the first kind of smirking receptions it got, low these many years ago, Clay?
Well, the interesting thing about Twitter is exactly this kind of five-year history you've pointed to, where it, because it started with a small group of people, it tended to be things only of interest to that group. And that was all the kind of techie crew you would expect to assemble at South by Southwest, mm-hmm. which is kind of where it got its start, the annual tech conference in Austin.
Right.
And it had this feel of just people playing around with it, what will this stuff do? But the important thing about Twitter as it grew is that it takes the public aspect of the web, right? The content is generally accessible. But the social network of Facebook, right? Material flows through the network because people forward it and re-forward it.
And there are no walls. You can follow anybody and it's all public. Whatever they tweet, it's there for anyone who wants to follow to see.
Right. There are a handful of ways that you can hide a tweet, either by direct messaging someone or having a protected Twitter handle, but almost all of it is public. And that publicness is what's become important. As the scale grew, the number of people who could synchronize themselves around a particular message has grown with it. You alluded to the citizen revolt, the consumer revolts around sort of Verizon and Bank of America at
yep.
the top of the hour.
Mm-hmm.
That's an example of what happens when a very large group of people has access to a public medium that also has social spread. And that's been the biggest change, I think, between 06 and now.
Andy Carvin, you're famous for using it in very focused ways that have swung a fair amount of throw weight. You spend a lot of time with it. What's your sense overall of how Twitter is used? I mean, it has had some pretty sharp elbows here, but in the main, here we are 5 years in. What's the usage you see, Andy?
Well, you know, see, it's kind of funny because if you went back and actually take a look at my very first tweet in 2007, I'm tweeting about making hummus and ripping up some pita for my family.
Okay.
So it's one of those
yep.
banal tweets about what we're having for lunch or for dinner. But you still see that today, and I think that's actually a good thing because people don't spend their entire time on Twitter talking about the most pressing issues at that particular moment. They spend their time reinforcing relationships. They want to know how their friends are doing, what's new in their lives. It's basically a form of social grooming, just like you'd see orangutans sitting around picking the nits off of each other.
Oh, great.
But that's important because even though it's banal, it reinforces the relationship. So when there's something really powerful to talk about or to address, they're ready to jump in head first.
Orangutans picking fleas off one another, Clay, is that it? And then what? When there's a tent goes up in Tahrir Square, all those people sharing their thoughts on how the sandwich they had at lunch are ready to come out and do something?
Well, I think Andy's exactly right. I mean, one of the things that holds human groups together is this sense of gossip. And in fact, It's not just an offhand observation. There's Ronald Dunbar, a famous primatologist, has said explicitly that language started as a form of alternate grooming in order to let humans coordinate themselves at larger scale. So I think that metaphor is actually, you know, deeply grounded in the way primates behave. But this sense that if we care about each other in all kinds of mundane ways, we'll also be tuned in when the big stuff happened, that's something we've seen. It works the other way too. I've become friends with people that I started following in the heat of the Arab Spring.
Right.
And first I thought there was a woman, Amira Al-Husseini, who was tweeting from Bahrain. And it became apparent reading her Twitter stream that she was starting to come under threat from the Bahraini government, who had become increasingly alarmed about her ability to broadcast a view of Bahraini protests different from what the government wanted.
Right, not the official line.
Not the official line. And I reached out to her. She and I happened to follow each other, so I could send her a direct message. And I was suddenly moved one day to say, you know, I hope you're okay. I'm reading you and thinking about you. And we've struck up a conversation as a result of this. I first followed her almost as a newscaster, but later came to care about what happened to her as a person.
Talk about power dynamics. I want to come to how Andy has used this himself. But Clay, big picture here. People are looking after 2011 at the relationship between individuals and the state, and many different states here, individuals and corporations. How has Twitter changed, or how is it changing those power dynamic relationships, Clay?
It is, and I think it's changing them because it allows large groups of people who aren't coordinated in any other way to relatively quickly take action. If you look at the Verizon example, where Verizon tried to add a $2 charge for paying your bill in anything other than an automatic recurring format.
And back in the day, that would have been just $2 for everybody, not enough to make a federal case.
Not enough, right? Yeah, 5% of people would have been upset enough to write a letter to Verizon, yeah, and nothing would have happened. Within 24 hours, people weren't only upsetting one another on Twitter and, of course, other social media. They'd actually written a caustic Christmas carol and had picked a Verizon store to coordinate on and sing it as a protest.
Why did Verizon folded? But why? Why do, I don't know, 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 tweets mean Verizon folds?
It's not the tweets that make Verizon fold. It's the fact that the tweets are connected to coordinated behavior. Because if Verizon were to lose even a few customers, mm-hmm, who then started broadcasting, I left Verizon for AT&T or I left Verizon for T-Mobile, they've suddenly lost more in a 72-hour protest than they would have gained in a year of $2 fees. And it's that ability for a group of people not just to take action, but to document their action and make the evidence available to other people that makes Twitter, and again, social media in general, such an important part of the ecosystem.
That is strong Twitter power. Andy Carvin, there's consumer and corporation. What about individual or individuals and state and the Twitter effect, Andy?
Well, if you paid attention to the Arab Spring as it began playing out late December of last year, the first people that were talking about it were either bloggers from Tunisia or Tunisians living in exile. In many ways, these are some of the people that you would assume to be the most disempowered people, given the way the government there had clamped, mm-hmm, down on freedom of press and freedom of speech. But in reality, it was actually the opposite, because all of these folks had something in common, that they were being oppressed with their speech by the government. And so they started networking with each other. So as word spread that this young man, Mohamed Bouazizi, had set himself on fire in the middle of nowhere in Tunisia, they began spreading the word. They began collecting videos of protests that were happening, sympathy protests in other cities. And so all of a sudden you had a group of Paul Revere's or Pied Piper's, pick your analogy, mm-hmm, but they were kind of doing both, where they're spreading the word and mobilizing people to take action simply by showing them there is a network of people who care about something very important happening right now, and you should get involved.
Clay, that had big impacts. I mean, you and Malcolm Gladwell had a big debate a year ago about how much social networking really mattered. You making the case it matters a lot in terms of challenging sitting power. Malcolm, yep, saying, well, there are other things that are much more important. Did you win the bet this year, Clay, or is it the jury still out?
You know, I don't think as so often with those big debates that the terms of it were completely clear. But what Malcolm was right about is that what he called clicktivism, just the kind of people sitting at their desktops clicking away for causes they care about, doesn't change anything.
On its own.
On its own. What I think he was wrong about and really visibly wrong in 2011 was that the idea that use of social media as a tool for synchronizing opinions, as a tool for coordinating action, was somehow incompatible with people willing to put their lives on the line for political causes. And he set up a dichotomy which revealed itself to be false really the day Bouazizi set himself on fire, as Andy said.
And then in the many more thousands as people tweeted and came out to Tahrir Square and faced down tear gas and everything else, not only because of Twitter, but it helps spark
it. And that's the thing I think we have to be careful about. One of the things I think that people don't understand about Twitter, and you mentioned this in your sort of – it's only 140 characters. One of the things you can get at 140 characters is a URL, which means that Twitter, the content of a tweet can actually point to anything you can express digitally. Mm-hmm. And so the importance of Twitter is you can't think about Twitter as its own separate medium. You've got to think about it as something that connects the larger web.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the time of Twitter and tweets and social networking at full throttle in 140 characters or whatever you care to throw up there with the links and all the rest. Andy Carvin joins us. He's senior strategist at NPR's social media desk and a real personage himself in terms of using Twitter, and this really blew up in the Arab Spring, to kind of channel news toward his followers, kind of curate the digital universe in real time, all kinds of input there. We'll talk about that and what it might mean for news. Clay Shirky is with us, big when it comes to thinking about the digital universe. Cognitive Surplus is his book. Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations, Think Occupy and all the rest. Andy, Clay, I want to go to our callers, but we've got feedback from the digital universe here. Vignor says, talking about Twitter, says illiteracy, loss of spelling and grammar, snark, irrelevant thoughts, incomplete ideas, and some fine haiku. Anna's a little more friendly toward it, says, I did not grasp the concept of Twitter, but dived in and now use it daily and find it a more challenging way to communicate concisely. Here's her prediction. She says, over the next year or two, most who Twitter will abandon Facebook, FB. And Dan says, as a millennial, I use Twitter and frequently. He says, of course, it's just another medium to get the word out as quickly as possible. If it wasn't Twitter, it'd be something else. Twitter just happens to be the easiest right now. Erica in Carlisle, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Erica. You're on the line with Andy Carvin and Clay Shirky.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great.
So I'm a student at the Rhode Island School of Design, and I use Twitter just to follow different design blogs. Before, I thought Twitter was kind of silly. I didn't care what celebrities were doing. I didn't want anyone to know what I was doing. But the easiest way for me to figure out what's going on in the design world is these design blogs that will tweet the newest thing that's coming out, and you get it immediately and you know what's going on. So it's really helpful.
So in a way, is it a kind of a news headline service for you, Erica, to point you to what, the latest, what's going on?
Yeah, definitely, because otherwise I would be searching through the internet, but this way it just kind of pops up and I know what's going on and it's really easy.
Do you share yourself? Do you tweet yourself, or are you just harvesting tweets?
I don't tweet. The only time I ever tweet is like retweeting, so if I think my friend should really see this certain thing that one of the blogs put out, then I'll retweet it, but I don't really think I have anything to say that I would want people to know that much.
You never know. You may change the world. Erica, thanks for calling. Andy Carvin, this puts us right in your wheelhouse. Now, in Erica's case, it's about the design world. Great. But it's become a news headline service for her that alerts her to what's going on. How is Twitter interacting or taking over the world of news, Andy?
Well, most news organizations have some form of Twitter presence right now, whether it's as simple as putting out their headlines or giving people the opportunity to interact with their anchors and their reporters and the like. And I think it varies from journalist to journalist as to whether or not that's going to help them in their reporting or get the word out about the reporting. There's really no way to say across the board that it works well or it doesn't work well. It's very idiosyncratic that way. Mm-hmm. But what I find Twitter most useful for is seeing my Twitter followers as my newsroom, because I don't really have a staff of people who can help me do research and serve as producers for me or editors for me. And so when I'm trying to capture what's going on in Syria or Libya or Egypt, my Twitter followers come out of the woodwork and they translate for me. They do research for me. They track shipping lanes and flights going in and out of airports. It's incredible the skills that people bring to the table. They may not be experts in the entire Arab Spring or a specific country, but they have either one area of expertise or local knowledge that allows them to contribute to the greater part of my news gathering. So I don't really see my Twitter account as a newswire per se. I see it as sort of an open source newsroom that anyone can come and participate in and observe the process.
I mean, you are a news guy with that instinct. Erica is using it to harvest. You're really putting the whole system to work in a very two-way manner. Clay Shirky, I mean, fill out this picture for us.
Erica's not just using it to harvest, and I thought her characterization of how she used it was very interesting. She said, I don't tweet, I just retweet.
Okay.
But in fact, what she's doing by retweeting is she's acting as a filter for her friends.
Curating.
And this is it. The really important thing to understand about social networks is they're both amplifiers and filters. They do a better job of getting you to the content you would care about, and at the same time, they do a good job of not showing you stuff they don't care about. So although Andy said lots of news organizations have Twitter streams, in fact, most of them will put out, you know, basically what they put out over the newswire.
Right.
We'll just throw it all out there and see what sticks. The stories that actually circulate are the stories that people like Erica make a judgment about and decide to share with her friends.
Well, isn't the
so in fact, she said, you know, essentially, I'm not a power Twitter user. But the power of Twitter is almost precisely because she's doing what she's doing, which is to make – you know, make the news sphere salient to her friends as well.
So point taken. I mean, her mind is being applied to this. She's curating. She's deciding what to pass on. I mean, and you know, we talk about news organizations with Twitter streams of their own. But, Clay, isn't that in a way the least of it? Aren't news organizations just become one among a million or a billion potential inputs here, the kind that Andy uses?
Yes, and you've got inputs that are, you know, obviously as small as an individual. And then at the other end of the scale, you know, Sweden this year has its own Twitter stream at Sweden. And they're giving over the ability to tweet on that Twitter handle to a different Swedish citizen every week of this year. So if the country is saying we're turning our branding over to our people, and I'm sure that there are all kinds of backstage, you know, controls over who gets to say what when. But it is, at the point at which a country has a Twitter handle and the citizens, the individuals are plugged into that, you really see the grid of the individual and the grid of the nation state operating in the same space.
Andy Carvin, I think about the old and the new here. Go all the way back to the Gulf War. I was a foreign editor for a big newspaper then. And at the very height of it, you know, when I had all my resources mustered, I probably had, and this was a lot for that time, I probably had 20 people. That I was, you know, guiding and tapping to learn about what was going on in that war in the Middle East. Now, you're playing on a kind of Wurlitzer organ here that's many times bigger than that, right?
That's a good description. Yes, some people compare it to DJing, but I like the organ reference. That's nice. But yeah, that's essentially what's going on. For any given country, I might be paying attention from anywhere from 25 to 250 people. And, you know, I adjust my lists accordingly based on need and what seems to be going on or about to go on. But after a while, you have to get develop an ability to know when something is potentially relevant and if something is chatter. And sometimes the chatter is important, but a lot of it isn't necessarily. And so,
how do you know when it's true? True.
What's interesting about figuring out what's true and what's not is knowing your sources and getting to understand what makes them tick. And so, many of the protesters in Egypt that I follow on Twitter, they happen to be amazing photographers and amazing bloggers. And so I see the content that they produce as a very important source, even though I never forget that they clearly have an agenda in what they're trying to accomplish. And so once you keep that in mind, it becomes possible to judge the content accordingly. But when it comes to breaking news, like let's say someone says someone is firing a gun in Tahrir Square, I typically don't see one person person tweet that. I typically see 20 or 30 people tweet that within a matter of seconds. And most importantly, from different locations around the square. And this is like a 1 mile radius area. So it's not like they're all standing around, a water cooler tweeting at the same time trying to punk me. And so it's kind of like a form of situational awareness where if you think of the film Black Hawk Down and the way they had a helicopter above shooting video footage and trying to do their best to manage what's going on down on the ground. I'm doing something similar, except rather than playing an active role, I'm trying to absorb it and make make sense of it and create some form of coherent narrative that the public can participate in.
And that's just a news use of this. Never mind all the social ones. Never mind. I mean, we heard from NATO during the whole Libya campaign. They were actually using Twitter feeds coming up from the ground to target bombs over Libya. Charlottesville, Virginia, Liner, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Okay. This is a report from another world. I'm 86. I can no longer read, so I don't use Twitter.
All right.
But your program has enlightened me to the extreme value that it has to our economy and to our world. My question is, can you think of any way that we might use Twitter to help our younger people return to curiosity about the world, that is, to the intellectual training, intellectual formation of a rising class?
Now, this is interesting. Andy, Clay, I know through the magic of the screen in front of me here that Liner called in from Charlottesville. And Liner, I know you'll back me up on this. You were skeptical just 15 minutes ago, right? Now, he's listening. He's warming up, but he's still worried about technology that may trap people in the moment. And he's looking for the depth here. Where do we get the depth and not just, endless whatever you're thinking right now chatter, Clay?
Well, one of the really interesting sort of hybrids between Twitter and the rest of the web are TED Talks, which are these condensed 15, 20-minute talks by, eminent scientists or entrepreneurs or what have you that take an idea or something they're working on and really try to make it clear to the general public.
Yep.
And TED Talks are one of those things that when one of them hits, it just rockets around. So I think the idea that people are somehow content to just be couch potatoes in this new medium, if that were true, something like a TED Talk, frankly, even something like Wikipedia, which is far more used than any mm-hmm. print reference work mm-hmm. ever was, wouldn't have the purchase on collective imagination it has. So I think to answer the question about young people in particular, I think that one of the things you can see on Twitter is people expressing a curiosity for the world that would not previously have been as easily fulfillable as they're able to do now. When I see something that I think someone else should look at, I can take it and tweet it out, and the people who follow me can see it. And if they like it, they can tweet it out, the mechanism we were talking about with Erica before.
Mm-hmm.
And when those things spread, I think it does create this kind of shared awareness, in part because if everybody's looking at the same thing at more or less the same time, it becomes not just individual consumption of ideas but actually a topic of conversation.
What about the loss of stillness, the loss of contemplation? Pico Iyer writing about it in the Time, New York Times over the weekend. Roger Cohen today, his headline is, a time to tune out. Twitter can be just one more thing that leads to compulsive use, Clay.
Right. I think that's true. And these media can be addictive. And I say this as someone who I would have characterized myself as an internet addict in 1993 and 1994. I had an almost physical craving to mm-hmm. be connected. There, I think it's not so much the individual medium as the collective, it is Twitter and Facebook and email and SMS and. The technology is never going to step away from us. We are going to have to step away from it. Now, Pico Iyer is going to the extreme of moving to rural Japan.
Rural Japan.
but, a half an hour a day or an internet Sabbath one day a week, it is one of those cases where since the environment now offers us all of this volume, exactly as with food, we suddenly have to take on a discipline in ourselves that we didn't have to take when either food or information were sparse.
Liner, what do your 86 years tell you about what you're hearing here?
Well, it's very enlightening. I don't hear an answer to my question, but I hear things that are going on that I was unaware of, and perhaps those could be built. I don't think I'm surrounded by young people, and I don't hear them talk about these values, these capabilities within being a Twitterite.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reminded of my early years. We were afraid that if satellites were used around the world, it would create knowledge to the public that would upset
the age-old rhythms of the universe, the planting season, or what? Human equilibrium?
They would upset the behavior of people. Arab Spring could not happen.
Yeah, yeah. And yet we're capable of a lot more than living in the village, I guess, and drawing from the same well every day, though. There's, Lord knows, there's beauty in that. It's fun. I'm thinking here, as we speak yesterday in this hour, we're sitting here talking about Homer's Iliad in new translation. That does not fit in a tweet. And yet I suppose it could go both ways. And maybe, Liner, you don't hear young people talking about it because they're just they can assume depth even as they tweet. I don't know, but I appreciate your call so much. And let me get – thank you. I'm glad you're listening. And let me get one more. Norman in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Norman, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to suggest there's a whole subculture on Twitter. We can call it Twitterature. Micro-poetry, haiku, all of epigrams, which are all organic to fit in 140 characters. I happen to have a site called Rhymes for Our Times, which are rhymed riffs on headlines, and suddenly I have 1,200 followers around the world.
You're a superstar. Do you have a couple for us? What have you got, Norman?
Yeah, here's one that was a headline in the Wall Street Journal. Confession makes a comeback, talking about people confessing online.
Yeah.
And
the
little 140 characters. Online confession made short and sweet. Google sin, type it in, hit delete.
I love it. It's great. Have you got another for us, Norman?
This was a headline, an AP dispatch, which was, "Is Twitter the future of diplomacy?" It was a story about a Swedish diplomat failing to use other forms of communication, got his message through on Twitter.
Yes.
And so the fate of the world in a Twitter release, we declare war, or let's live in peace.
Norman, all my love. I love what you're doing with that. No wonder you have 1,200 followers. What's your handle, Norman?
Rhymes for Our Times.
Rhymes for Our Times. Twitterati, be clued in to Norman. Norman, I appreciate that call so much. I mean, Andy Carvin, there it is. It's not as though it can't be artful, full of humor, full of fun.
And that's what you see on Twitter all the time. People use Twitter to amplify their passions, whatever it may be. And so I think it goes to the previous caller's question about what do you do to get people, young people, excited and curious again? Well, if you go on Twitter and you look in the right places, you will see teenagers talking about social sciences and anthropology and physics because they really care about it and they're finally finding similar like-minded kids.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the time of Twitter and social networking at full throttle. Terrific couple of guests with us today. Clay Shirky is here from NYU. Wired Magazine calls him one of the handful of people with justifiable claim to the Digerati moniker. Cognitive Surplus is his book. Here Comes Everybody. His Twitter handle is C. Shirky. Plugged In. Talk about Plugged In. Andy Carvin, senior strategist at NPR's social media desk, has made a big name for himself in hanging on to so many reins at once across the Wurlitzer, or keys, I guess, across the Wurlitzer of all the Twitter inputs that he's paying attention to. And out of that, creating a kind of incredible new style of news stream. His Twitter handle is A. Carvin. Clay, I heard you give a speech across the river here in Cambridge a couple of months ago. I mean, you go pretty big on this. Give us your sort of really big picture on where this is going in terms of human communication and how it changes human interaction, how it changes power over time, Clay.
Well, that talk was at Shorenstein, at the Shorenstein Center up at Harvard's Kennedy School. And it was about essentially freedom of speech, not as a legal doctrine, but as an actual practical capability.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the big deals about, again, Twitter and social media in general,
yep,
Twitter and all of the other things it can point to, is that it makes freedom of speech a lived experience for millions and millions of people who previously could only express their thoughts and opinions to the number of people they could gather in their dining room. And that change is the big deal politically. And what's really interesting is seeing the world's governments try to grapple with that in one way or another. The Bahraini government, when people were going online and criticizing Bahrain for their violent, murderous crackdown against their own citizens, the Bahraini government began to harass them online. If you tweeted anything about Bahrain, this egg, this Twitter user whose profile picture just showed up as an egg because they
didn't
upload anything, anonymous basically, would come in and start harassing you. The Russian government has recently taken to flooding hashtags so that if somebody tries to put in an identifier about an event that anybody can follow, in order to prevent that identifier, in this case the name of Revolution Square from being useful, the Russian state will simply flood it with all kinds of material that's either irrelevant or hostile to the views of the people out in Revolution Square. And so we really are at the beginning of the full-on arms race. For a long time, the citizens were simply able to use these tools, and the governments of the world either didn't think they were important or simply didn't understand them. Those days are now over, and this is, I think, going to be the first year where there is a full-on attempt to prevent citizens from using free speech as an actual practical capability when the state doesn't want people to do it.
I want to look at that pushback, but Andy, just on this kind of freedom of speech, it leaves me wondering if this new sort of auxiliary nervous system or information flow, call it what you will, if it changes the old stasis, the old status quo, does it mean that, you know, institutions are simply going to be less powerful, less stable? When a whole lot of individuals have their ways to, you know, take sometimes very high leverage little nibbles out of the flanks of these big, powerful institutions.
Well, I think that's already happening. If you just take a look at the Hollywood movie industry, movies used to have a shelf life of many, many weeks before they were considered a hit or a flop. But nowadays, you can go and look on Twitter for the handful of people who got a preview of it, and they'll be so vocal about how good or how bad it is, it often withers on the vine right there. And so, you know, across all sorts of disciplines, whether it's the filmmaking industry or government or books or entertainment, sports, what have you, there's already a critical mass of people out there who not only have strong opinions, but are influencers themselves. Because, again, it's not about Twitter itself as the platform. It's about the human networks that are created by it. And those people act as nodes spreading their opinions. And that can have great consequences for whatever it is they happen to be talking about.
And we've seen it already. Carl in Kingston, Rhode Island. Thanks for calling, Carl. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi. And what we're talking about here is, you've just talked about, is connected with what I'm saying. There can be monitoring of these things. And what happened with my alma mater, which went to the postseason football playoffs?
Okay.
And then, and I'm not going to mention the name of the alma mater of the university,
okay,
their best player, their best end, the receiver,
okay,
he made some tweet, right? And this was picked up, and who monitored, I don't know, and it got back to the NCAA. So the NCAA banned him from the next football game that my alma mater had, and of course they lost. Now I have no idea what the mechanism was of monitoring this internet and actually finding him and getting back to him. But is this something that governments are likely to do? And you've been talking about them, you know, jamming the thing.
Yeah.
Why can't they find out the name of someone and you know, this guy was severely punished. I don't know what he said.
He had real-world consequences for that tweet that he made. Carl, I'm glad you raised that. I mean, there's a college football instance of it. But we've also got, here's a listener online, Andy Clay, who writes, I've been involved in both Iran and Syria. talk about dangerous zones, during the past 6 years as a conduit for a certain dialogue. That sounds like a euphemism. And I question the utility of Twitter. Isn't it too risky for key agitators to expose themselves on a traceable system? Aren't core participants in this process of change truly in place without Twitter and their actions better kept off of all forms of social networks, Clay?
Yes, that's absolutely true. But the key there is the core question. You can't have something like Tahrir Square without a core of activists who know and trust each other and try to keep their actions secret from the state. But you also can't have Tahrir Square without mass involvement, without the so-called information cascade that allows people to see that other people are also risking their lives. So Twitter is, by being almost all public, not a good place to keep secrets. I think to the question about both football and the political activists, to find out what someone is saying on Twitter doesn't require monitoring because they're saying it in public. In fact, all the NCAA would have to do is search through a list of players it knows to be on Twitter looking for public statements. So there wasn't anything complicated there. And it's certainly not a place to put, here is the secret group of people that's going to try and get to Tahrir Square in the place the police are not looking. That there is still an aspect of political agitation that has to be secret.
Andy,
but if it is just a small core group doing the work and not a large group converted to the cause, Those kinds of political actions will also fail.
Well, I mean,
Twitter is more useful for the second half of that.
Well, you've said, Clay, that the empire always strikes back.
Right.
And if 2011 was the year when a million or 100 million of the Twitterati had their influence, I think you were saying earlier that you can feel countries, corporations sort of gathering their strength now, their strategies. I mean, I'm reading here an AP story. The CIA is actively monitoring social media networks. You talked about Russia. You talked about many countries in the Middle East doing this. I mean, right here, we're broadcasting from Boston, where they had Occupy Wall Street came to Boston. And, local authorities, the Boston DA, subpoenaed Twitter over Twitter handles that they want to track down to, I guess, individuals. I mean, Andy, maybe there's free speech here, but if every time you tweet, you've got to wonder if someone's going to, trace it right down and show up at your front door the next day or a month later. I don't know if that's free speech, Andy.
Well, it's like any other medium where you have the opportunity to talk publicly. It's a blessing and a curse. You are taking, in some cases, an extreme risk by saying things, especially using your own name. But nonetheless, every single day I talk to people in various parts of the Middle East who are open about their real names, and they're not concerned. And I think it's because they just see what they're doing is so important that they don't want to hide behind it. I remember not long after President Ben Ali fled the country in Tunisia, a Tunisian friend of mine just happened to be going to the U.S., by coincidence. And so I invited her over to NPR to have a little conversation with folks. And at some point, someone asked her, why on earth did you use your Facebook account to get involved with this? Everyone could see your name. And her response was, yes, precisely, because either we were going to win or we were going to lose. And if we lost, that meant either death, incarceration, exile, very bad options. And so she took the position that if I'm going to try to go all the way with this, I want people to remember me for who I was and not some random anonymous name. I want it to be on the public record.
That comes home very powerfully. These may be short, but the relationships that get amplified and made, as you say, Claire, very real. Back in the height of Tahrir Square, we talked with Mona Etelhawi, Egyptian-American woman. Fantastic passion and enthusiasm. And then, just a couple of months ago, here comes her tweet, beaten, arrested in interior ministry. And she had a very hard time of it. And suddenly, this is somebody we know and we care about and we know about, Clay, because that tweet comes through.
Right. And this, one of the big surprises to me of the Arab Spring has been how incredibly important not just coordination of action but documentation of results has been. When Gaddafi was under extreme pressure extreme military pressure in Libya, he nevertheless instructed soldiers who were watching people flee the country into either Tunisia or Egypt to shake them down for cell phones and USB sticks because he did not want documentation to leave the country. And what Mona was able to do was to offer up her own local reporting, the most local report. I am reporting what has happened to me.
Yeah.
And that ability, it's not the same as a secret plot for people meaning to overthrow the government, but that ability also has real political ramifications.
I lost count, she tweeted, of how many hands tried to get into my trousers. She's being beaten. Oh, she's God. Being assaulted. She was there in the Interior Ministry in Egypt. But we know about it. We know about it step by step. Let's go to Washington State. Everett in Washington State. Wonderful. Joel, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. My comment is that in order to try and keep from getting lost in the minutiae of the day, of the barrage of information that comes at us, I read the editorial page of the local newspaper, Goodwin, the Seattle Times, daily. And that helps to get me focused back on what's important and keep me from losing track of where I'm going. Otherwise, I'd be buried.
So are you afraid of Twitter as just a bigger ocean to be lost in, Joel?
I've already got too many things going on. I'm retired. I mean, I'm buried in all my other interests. And so to add another, unplug another dam, another reservoir of stuff flowing at me would just be too much.
Please, Lord, no. Andy Carvin, speak to this. I think a lot of people look at Twitter. It's not, it's not as neatly packaged for you as the New York Times front page, let's say. I mean, do you have to be a super pro to go in here and not just be overwhelmed?
No. I mean, I'm certainly an outlier because I tweet at a ridiculous, absurd rate. And so no one should use me as a role model by any means. But, nonetheless, it's when people first go on Twitter, the first thing I always recommend to them is find out which of your friends are on Twitter and find out the people that you find the most interesting in the world. See if they're on Twitter as well. See if Stephen Hawking is there. See if a biologist is there. See if a politician is there. Mm-hmm. And not only see what they're tweeting, seeing if they're talking to people, if they're engaging them, because you might be able to join that conversation. So I don't necessarily see Twitter as yet another activity that you have to put on top of everything else and decrease your time spent on those other things. I actually see Twitter as a way to really hone in on the stuff you care about already and get even better information about it. So the example he gave about sitting down and reading the local op-ed page every day. I do the same thing with the New York Times and a couple other papers, but then I take a look at Twitter and I see what all my friends are reading in terms of op-eds. And so they're often reading newspapers, magazines, and journals that would never occur to me, but they serve as a filter for me for the best opinions going on any given morning. And so that feeds my interests in op-eds even more.
Elizabeth in Radnor, Pennsylvania, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I use Twitter. Akasa and I are doing a project about the youth pushing for government reform, and Twitter is pretty much the main medium that we've gotten all of our information and our interviews, and I mean, it's been a huge help for us.
So you look up who may be of interest to you, you find their handle, you send them a message saying, can we talk about the subject, and off you go.
Yeah, and then, we email back and forth, or we get a Skype interview through them, and I mean, we originally started because our class and I got a grant to work with the American University of Cairo, and then we just went from there, and we started talking to people from Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Philly, and we've gotten some people from the Ukraine and Russia to tell us what's going on there. So, I mean, Twitter has allowed us to get in touch with people that we never would have been able to.
That's pretty cool and pretty empowering, and we hear that loud and clear, Elizabeth. Good luck with it. That's terrific. Hey, Clay, we read, very recently, that this Saudi prince, I guess, Al-Walid bin Talal, bought $300 million worth of equity stake in Twitter. Now, that's not a very big stake, even $300 million, just bought, percent, 5%, something pretty small. But why would a Saudi prince want to own a piece of Twitter just as an investment, or is there own it, shut it down, turn it around? What?
I don't know anything about this particular investor, but I think the reason you'd invest in Twitter is you thought it was going to make money.
Okay.
Particularly since he didn't buy a very large chunk of it. And Twitter, I have to say, has been better than really any other commercial social network at defying law enforcement in their desire to extract information about citizens while not telling the citizens they're doing it. They have continuously gone to court to say, yes, we will answer the subpoena because it's a lawful subpoena, but we're going to tell the person whose information has been subpoenaed. So Twitter, in fact, is one of the great defenders of civil liberties on the internet. I don't think that there's probably any sense that that could be readily bought.
Twitter versus Facebook, where's the future, Clay? Our time is short here, but where's the growth?
It's not in versus. Facebook, because it is a two-way connection. You mm-hmm. and I, to be friends, have to be connected to each other. Mm-hmm. Twitter is a one-way connection. I can follow you without you following me. Mm-hmm. Have very different styles of information flow. Facebook is more social. Twitter is more essentially open and public. They will step on each other's toes at the edges, but the center case for each network is going to remain different.
And Andy Carvin, does traditional news and Twitter news, do they coexist or does one have to triumph here?
I don't think one triumphs because you're already seeing journalists get very creative in how they use Twitter as part of their sourcing and news gathering. And so I think it's going to make better journalists out of a lot of us and also bring new journalists into the fold.
Well, it's a great update after a big, big year for Twitter, and we're very grateful to the two of you. Clay Shirky, author of Cognitive Surplus, and Here Comes Everybody. Always great to have you with us, Clay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
And Andy Carvin with NPR. It's great to have you right there, Andy, and so great to have you with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio. Follow me at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. It's all there. Thanks for being here today. This is On Point.